Morning. It's 11 minutes before 8 a.m. This is KCAW in Sitka. Today is Monday, December 16th, 2013. I'm Melissa Marconi-Wenzel with Raven News. Sitka's Pacific High won some major recognition recently, including a photo in USA Today. But the honor wasn't for the usual things that schools are recognized for, like academics or sports. Instead, the recognition was for the school's food. Pacific High was a prize winner in the Division of Agriculture's 2013 Alaska Farm to School Challenge after its students prepared a lunch of locally sourced coho and other Alaska-grown ingredients. The contest was part of a statewide effort to encourage Alaskan schools to use local ingredients in school lunches. KCAW's Emily Foreman reports.
In USA Today's photo gallery of American school lunches, Pacific High's teriyaki coho salmon skewers stand out. The pink salmon chunks with silver skin attached, garnished with scallions resting on a bed of brown rice, alongside roasted potatoes, looks pretty sophisticated. Sitka-grown ingredients sit conspicuously on the plate, in no shape resembling a nugget or a hot dog.
Oh yeah, we're still shooting carrots, aren't we?
3 hours before lunch, Olina Valley, a freshman at Pacific High, and two AmeriCorps volunteers start prepping enough cornmeal-encrusted rockfish, cilantro tartar sauce, vegetable slaw, and chips and salsa to feed 20 students. They're trying out a new meal.
You just gotta, like, feel for the bone, and then you gotta grab it, and you kind of have to pull it out. It's harder because when I used to do this when I was younger, I didn't get pliers.
Olina debones rockfish like a pro, from years of practice. She is part of a cooking class at Pacific High aimed at teaching tangible culinary skills and healthy eating. Students can get a food handler's card after taking the class, a small step leading to employment. A few of the seniors work at restaurants in town.
Perfect, perfect. You're doing great. So that's separating an egg.
Abby Long, an AmeriCorps volunteer, leads the class and designs the menus.
It almost seems like eating locally supports Alaskan culture. You know, some people want to eat locally to reduce their carbon emissions or to support their local economy, and it's just the idea that it's so much larger than that here.
She tries to incorporate as many local ingredients as possible. And in this case, local means ingredients from the entire state of Alaska.
So I have to approach these growers and be like, hey, do you mind getting a flat rate box and seeing how many onions you can fit in it for me and then pricing it that way?
But for Pacific High students, it seems the most valuable lesson comes from gathering ingredients from Sitka rather than a flat rate box.
Students really love to be able to teach something to their teachers. You should have seen it. We got some crab off a boat a couple of weeks ago. And so we have these two AmeriCorps volunteers from down south, and they're like, what do I do with this, you know? And so then these kids, they come out and they're like, well, you just do this and you just do this, and then you throw the guts on the ground, and you know, it's just so funny.
Pacific High's co-principal Sarah Ferenczi says scenes like this validate her vision for a student-run, locally sourced lunch program. She says that working with local ingredients gives students the opportunity to share skills from their upbringing.
It validates students, it gives them a sense of self-worth, and it helps them be successful.
Beyond cultivating confident students, Ferenczi sees the lunch program evolving to encompass much more.
It's about breaking the cycle of poverty, ultimately, is really the big issue for me. If our students know how to grow and prepare and preserve food, then that is one of their basic needs that they are able to meet through their own independent skills.
Recognition from the Division of Agriculture is nice, but it's not about the prize. It's about what students gain in the process. The next step is to make the rockfish meal as sustainable and replicable as it is photogenic and delicious. In Sitka, I'm Emily Foreman.
The U.S. Forest Service this month is taking more public comments on a plan to close 9 recreational cabins on the Tongass National Forest. Officials say the structures are not maintained and hardly used. In addition, other recreation sites on the Tongass could be considered for closure in the future. Joe Vicknicki reports.
The Forest Service says it's not able to cover the costs of operation and maintenance for the 152 recreational cabins on the Tongass and is proposing to close 9 of them. An environmental assessment document published in November outlines the agency's plans. Victoria Hauser, recreation planner on Prince of Wales Island, says those cabins are in bad shape.
These particular cabins that are being looked at in this document are ones that may not have been used for the last 10 years. They haven't even been on the reservation system, some of them. And they're like a tree hit one of them and it's completely knocked down. These ones are kind of the obvious ones that if we get rid of them, hopefully it's not going to be a huge change to the cabin system in general.
The nine proposed for removal are the Beaver Camp, Cheekat's Lake, and Red Alders Cabin near Ketchikan, Binkley Slough at the mouth of the Stikine River near Wrangell, and DeBoer Lake near Thomas Bay on the mainland north of Petersburg. Also on the list are Maksutov and Rezanov Lake cabins on southern Baranof Island south of Sitka, Square Lake near Yakutat, and McGilvery Cabin in the Karda Wilderness area on Prince of Wales Island. Hauser says that McGilvery Cabin is an example of one that's no longer safe.
It's terribly full of black mold because the skylight in the top is broken out, and so it just gets wet and disgusting in there. It's not healthy to stay there. And it would cost a lot of money to replace it.
The agency estimates it would cost $1.8 million to replace these cabins as well as others that are slated for conversion to shelters. Rental fee revenue from the cabin program forest-wide each year totals just over $300,000. Meanwhile, the agency has a backlog of maintenance work from stocking woodsheds to cleaning out pit toilets in all of the forest's remote cabin locations. The budget for the Tongass Cabin program this past year was $1.3 million. That's been dropping, and it's expected to continue shrinking. Hauser says the agency's budget and location of the remote structures also enter into the decision.
A lot of the ones that are in this document aren't being used at all, and so they're not bringing in any fees. And also they're hard for us to get to. They're really remote and really expensive to fly to. It's hard for us to maintain. It's also hard for people to get to them and use them. So those things all compound and make these ones difficult to keep up and keep up. And with our declining budget, it's hard for us to maintain them.
The nine cabins would have the metal and glass removed and then either be burned or left to rot into the forest floor. Forest Service says it's received comments from the public seeking to keep the Cheekat's Lake cabin near Ketchikan. Other comments in general supported keeping cabins in the wilderness areas to provide for health and safety, according to the environmental document. The agency already had one public comment period on the plans to close the cabins last year. This second comment period ends December 20th. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Find a link to the cabin document and how to comment online at our website, kcaw.org, under Southeast News. And scientists are finding more evidence that Southeast Alaska's first residents arrived more than 10,000 years ago. It's coming through a new method of locating early settlements. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on the search for ancient shorelines in a region where sea level is not a constant thing.
It's like a sandy loam that's just got a lot of organic.
Dave Damore digs into a hole on the Juneau campus of the University of Alaska Southeast. He's looking for evidence that this spot, about 100 feet above sea level, was once an ocean shore.
I can kind of see it now. This looks like it's organic.
Yeah, and then you
over
hit
that
sand.
Beach. There's that beach.
And then you hit organic again underneath.
Oh, you do? Oh, interesting.
Damore is a soils expert with the U.S. Forest Service's Pacific Northwest Research Station. He's one of the scientists working with university students to map Juneau's ancient shorelines.
If I had my rubber boots, this is the approach.
They're hard to find because of the region's ever-changing geography. The weight of huge glaciers depressed the Earth's crust. Their forward movement created raised bulges of land. Their melting allowed the surface to rise, and then there's plate tectonics. Early residents, Tlingit Indians or their predecessors, lived along these shores, so finding their camps and villages, sometimes hundreds of feet above today's sea level, can lead to new discoveries.
One of those 3-gallon bottles.
Dan Monteith is an anthropology professor at the university. He's scooping water out of another hole where he hopes to find something interesting.
We're going around following up different river drainages or cut banks looking for evidence of old ancient raised marine beaches.
They've already found some. Monteith walks up a small creek to an eroded bank. There, sticking out of the soil, are small, dirty white seashells.
By collecting shell and other things from those areas, then we can radiocarbon date those and get kind of a fixed point of when that was a beach at different points in time.
The technique was developed on Prince of Wales Island. Forest Service geologist Jim Bechtel says it can be used to make an educated guess of where early residents used to live.
Just as you and I today would camp within 2 to 3 feet above high tide, so were folks in the past. And then if you had food and you had good shelter and good moorage, that's the kind of places we would camp.
Bechtel, archaeologist Risa Carlson, and other scientists began their effort about 4 years ago. On an early outing, they headed up an estuary and into the forest to where waves lapped the shore thousands of years before.
And we dug down about 50 centimeters and dug into the top of over a meter of charcoal and tools and other things that were left there by the inhabitants at that place.
Radiocarbon dating showed those items to be about 10,000 calendar years old. Bechtel says he and other scientists used the technique to find archaeological material on more than 70 Prince of Wales Island sites. About 10 have been dated to around that same time, showing Southeast's first residents were well established by then. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Want to see what Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan looked like when the sea level was higher? Check out our website, kcaw.org. It's 8 a.m. Have a good morning.